Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee and Coach Chad Timmerman is with me.
Hello.
And so is our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello. That was my Chad impression.
Pretty good.
This is where you can get answers to your coaching questions. Forgive me. So you can submit them to us at support@trainerroad.com. And we will, we'll be able to sort through as many questions as we get, pick out the ones that we can answer, and answer them here on the podcast for you. You can find this podcast on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or on Stitcher. And you can leave us reviews there, leave comments on SoundCloud, and we can see those there, ask questions there too, all of that works. And we can pull through all that stuff and connect with you guys. We love it. That's why we do this. So let's kick things off right now with Craig's question. Actually, it's not a question, just a thanks. And I actually put this in here because I wanted to let you guys know that we do see it when you guys just send in a thank you note and we appreciate it. So Craig says, no question, just wanted to say thanks. I've been using Trainer Road since last August. For the last 5 months, and you say that you live in Colorado, I've been doing base plans and riding inside. Since the weather yesterday in Colorado was nice, I had to do 4 hours and decided to do it outside. First, I averaged almost 17 miles per hour for the whole 4 hour ride, which for me is about 2 miles per hour faster than previous rides.
Awesome.
Second, yeah, that's strong, right? Second, I felt strong the whole ride and did not hang on, in quotes, at the end. Third, I included a 1.5 mile climb with a 13% peak gradient on it and was able to accomplish it without an issue. This is especially encouraging as it's my first climb of the year and I'm usually not this strong yet. So good job, Craig.
And two, good to just hear. As we're getting the summer months, and what happens with Trainer Road is a lot of people will suspend their account. They're like, I'm going to ride outside the whole time, and I understand, but this is my CEO speaking, and from a fitness standpoint, if you can do your weekday workouts inside and then do those longer endurance rides outside, man, you talk to anyone who does that, and that is the secret sauce for in the summer. I think, Chad.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I would watch every year the same pattern that would happen with the people who came in consistently, religiously over the course of November, December, January, maybe even into February. Weather got good, they headed back outside, did those first early Tuesday night criteriums or road races or time trials or our local race series, and they were flying. They were crushing people. Their friends were asking them, what'd you do this winter? I mean, everything was on track. And then they shifted all their training to outdoors. And the same pattern happened every time. It was just a slow decline into a lot of them would kind of hang up the bike for the season. A lot of them would start riding socially and stop racing. Those that did race were just kind of banging their heads against the wall.
Yep. Yeah. It sounds like that coming from us since we all work for Trainer Road. But to be honest, I always get asked. Like last year, for example, I had a peak and I was doing really well in March, punching above my weight. In April, I had a mini peak where I did fantastic. May, I did well in, actually, I should say in early June, I did really well. In July, I peaked for nationals and did fantastic. And then in September, I was still racing well. And it was because I was managing my training and being disciplined about it. It's very easy to do when it's inside. When you get outside, kind of goes all out the window. Now, that doesn't mean that I didn't ride outside. I rode every day almost at lunch outside, but I would still do my trainer workouts, my three workouts a week or whatever it was. I would do those workouts during the week and make sure that I wasn't working too hard when I was outside. It works. Makes you faster, man. It's all about structure. So let's go into Johan's question. He says, I'm looking for research or articles that link the way in which Trainer Road tests FTP. And we have an 8-minute test or a 20-minute test, for those who don't know, to the results or graded exercise tests. More specifically, the watt max and lactate threshold methods obtained during such a test. So he's looking for any type of, I guess, evidence that kind of backs up the tests we use, Chad, or compares them to existing tests.
Yeah, so I don't have anything specific outside of resources, Johan. And I know you asked also how this relates to a step test. The two are very different things and they measure different things. So that's maybe a topic for another time. But as far as the resources, my go-to resources, I use basically two things and then the internet in general. And those two things are PubMed. So if you go to pubmed.gov, They have a little search engine. You plug in any topic like this and you're going to get a lot of articles. And you kind of got to sift through and find the ones that are related. Yeah, I mean, obviously you can streamline your search criteria down to be cycling or endurance related. But that's a super helpful resource and you'll find more reading than you can possibly keep up with. And then the other resource is the Google Wattage Forum. There's always conversations going back and forth. New topics crop up all the time. Old topics get beaten to death. They get a little contentious, but always interesting. And you have to apply for membership or admittance to the Google Wattage Forum. But I'm not sure they're too strict. They just want to make sure people are there to learn and they're there for the right reasons. But between those two, you should be able to research yourself thoroughly.
Yeah, that's exact. I don't have anything else to add. Nate, do you?
Nope.
Cool. Then let's move on to Graham's question. Graham says, what training should you do with a cold or cough, et cetera? Training at a lower level if illness is above the neck. That's his one suggestion he adds. And this is timely, as you can tell, mm-hmm. I'm sure, as everyone can hear.
You're still sick from last week, Jonathan? No, we're recording this podcast back to back, so
we are. We're doing two since we're gonna two be. In a row. It's gonna be tough to hit things out of time. So, Chad, what do you say?
Yeah. So, Graham, I've always stuck to the whole: if it's above the neck, you can get away with training. If it's below the neck and it's in your chest, you pretty much gotta take it easy. And I've abided by that for many, many years, and it's worked for me. It's worked for riders I've coached as well. Two things you have to keep in mind: if it's above the head, you can do what you want. You just have to realize that training stress is stress. And if your body's already stressed with an illness, you're going to kind of set the stage for it to be, for you to be ill longer, or maybe increase the severity of that illness. So I wouldn't recommend anything too intensive, basically tempo and below. That's up to you though. You want to try some sweet spot repeats and you know, maybe you get through them and you don't feel any worse and you heal on a decent time course, then you got it right. But, a sweet spot would probably be the upper end of it for me with a head cold.
Mm-hmm. And I've noticed too that with just a cold, I can usually train through pretty well. But if I get a sinus infection, man, when I get a sinus infection by 3 o'clock, I'm just kind of wiped. That's without any training. And that's when I try to rest more to get over that. And that segues mm-hmm. into an update for my, I was just talking about this, for my sleep apnea kind of sinus problem, is I went and saw, in case anyone cares, I don't know if they do, but I went and saw an ENT with my scans of my sinus, and I have a really big polyp in my left sinus. They said they're not going to remove that, but it also showed that my sinuses were extremely inflamed. I think my doctor said 95% restricted. So I have problems breathing through my nose, and I have a deviated septum. So in a couple weeks here, I'm going to go in and get surgery.
I just want to clarify that we don't know, like Chad and I talking to Nate, it doesn't seem like Nate has anything particularly different going on. So I think that a lot of people might actually be resonating with this, right? Like they might wonder why they're not resting as well. They might wonder why they're getting sick more often or anything else like this. And Nate's situation's anecdotal, but hopefully it's insightful.
Yeah, to go back a little bit, my wife would hear me like kind of gasp in the middle of the night, and I would sleep 9-10 hours and still be tired. So I went and saw a sleep doctor, and he just looked at some of like into my nose and stuff, and he goes, I think you might have some problems. And I got a CT scan, and then that really showed what is going on with my sinuses. Saw the ENT. She's also going to remove my tonsils, which she said could be causing harboring an infection and make me have more sinus infections. And I also got more complete blood work for immune deficiency, which I had a low IgG3 before, and I got that back, and I haven't seen that doctor yet. I actually see them next week, the doctor that's looking at my immune deficiency. But there's like on my test, they tested like 15 things, and like 8 of them are on the low side. So they're not really sure how they all relate. But what I'm hoping is, so the ENT, what she's gonna do is she's gonna fix a deviated septum, and then she's also doing two other things in there. And she's basically, I think she called them, there's probably an ENT listening, he's going to laugh, but turbinates, sure. Or it's hard. They talk so fast in that room. It's all jargon too. But she's basically going to open up pathways in my sinuses so that I can breathe better. And she's not going to actually remove that giant polyp. It looks like disgusting. If you look at my CT scan, it's probably the size of a silver dollar. And like if I Google polyps and sinuses, I don't see any of them that big. But she says that won't restrict my breathing and it's benign. So she'll kind of poke at it. And unless it's, I think she said if it's full of fluid, there's one case where she'll remove it. But in general, they'll just leave it there. The whole thing, I should probably put me out of training and work for like a week, which is totally lame because I'm keep having things that you guys probably feel this way. I'll have, you know, I was sick, then I went on vacation, then I had a short work trip, and then I'm getting surgery, then we have a company retreat that's going to take me out, and then I have another work trip, and just these little like 4-day things at a time. Yeah, it's consistency, right? And it's just, it hurts me. But I just do the best that I can. So that's the update right now. Yeah. My goal is that after I get the sinus surgery, my nose will be able to breathe correctly, and I won't have to, probably the sleep apnea will just go away.
You'll have Cancellara watts. It'll be amazing.
Yeah, you're going to crank out a 300 watt threshold 6 weeks later.
Well, hopefully what will happen is, my thinking is I'll either have to sleep, I'll be able to sleep less, or I'll recover better when I sleep, because I will, mm-hmm. instead of waking up 120 times per night, you know, I'll wake up 10 times per night. Yeah, that's the,
and that's not an over exaggeration. 120
yeah.
times.
Yeah, no, so that's what they tested, is that I really did wake up 120 times a night.
So crazy. Question from a different Johan. He says, "Hi guys, my question is this: can you limit progression by having many hard workouts without overtraining?" So he gives us a little bit of background. Where he's a really active guy. He's doing some weight training, doing a lot of different stuff. He says, I'm doing strength training regularly besides my cycling, on average about 2 times a week with heavy weights and a few reps to gain as much strength as possible without adding too much weight. I train my whole body every time with squats, heel raises, and leg curls as the main leg exercises. A normal week can consist of 2 weight training sessions and 3 interval or sweet spot sessions on the spinning bike in the gym. In other words, 5 medium to hard workouts a week. Right now, both the strength training and the cycling last for about 60 to 90 minutes each workout. In addition, I usually play football, that's soccer for us here stateside, once a week. Good man for playing soccer. I'm a big soccer fan. So when the spring comes and I can ride outside, I will start to have more longer endurance rides, not only different types of intervals. I believe this is quite a high training load. So back to my original question, can having this many hard workouts a week limit my progress in both cycling and in general? I don't feel tired on a regular basis, but once in a while, when I do take some time off, I'm not too concerned about overtraining. I think he's just taking it off for other reasons. He mentions that he's 23 years old. I've been training since his childhood, cycling for about 10 years pretty consistently. So he believes his body can take on quite a bit. Chad, your thoughts on that, about can this many hard workouts cause him to get fatigued like that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I like that he's viewing a lot of training, but not pushing to the point of overtraining. So basically he's describing a training plateau and what appears to be a long-term one. But basically, Johan, your body handles so much stress, you allow it to absorb that stress via recovery, and then you come back stronger. But if you're never really allowing the recovery, or never really allowing that adaptation to take place, then you're basically just topping out at one spot and then just staying there for a good long while. And it's a fun mix. It sounds really varied and interesting. And if you don't have any big competitive goals, it might not be the worst thing. I do know that you have taken some time off and you feel better coming back into it. I'm pretty sure that was mentioned in there somewhere, mm-hmm. which tells me that, much like myself, when I get just a little bit of distance on it and I can remember what it feels like to feel fresh and really attack my workouts and see my numbers start to climb again, it's a bit of an eye opener, and it brings a whole lot of enjoyment back to the whole process of training.
Yeah. I think the two things that are key on this is, one, he's 23. So that's going to probably be one of the top recovery times of his whole entire life. And yep. and two, you know, this could be working for you, but if you, you know, you're not, if you want to be really competitive, I would just, you know, add two or three extra cycling workouts a week. But I mean, if it's fine, like if you're not getting tired from it and, you know, like Chad said, put some, periodization in, some recovery, but if you're not getting tired, it's okay to do that. But if you want peak training, it'd probably be better just to cycle more and follow a more structured approach.
Yeah, basically, you're just going to have to choose what's most important to you. If you want to keep this varied approach and just enjoy your days and enjoy that variety, then more power to you. You're on a good track. But if you want to really improve in any one of those things, it's going to have to come at the expense of something else.
Yeah, exactly right. It's all about focusing. You have, even at 23, while your ability to sustain a certain amount of training volume or stress may be higher than another, it's still where you direct that stress will show results. So as long as it's offset with a proper recovery, I mean, and it sounds like it is in your case. He says, final words, I don't have the opportunity to use my tax trainer where I live right now, but he mentions he's a student, so that's probably the case. But we'll definitely start using Trainer Road next winter. I have Vector pedals on my bike, but I don't believe Trainer Road is made for riding outdoors. That's his question there. And it's certainly not made for riding outdoors. But I know Chad and I have used the app outdoors. We just hook up an ant dongle and we pick up our power data when we ride. Nate, I don't know if you've ever done that. We get a lot of people that mention that too.
Yeah, because I'm not going to be using, I'm going to not actually look at the screen.
So exactly.
I could just use a Strava or my Garmin or something to record the data to make sure I have that.
Yeah, essentially, if you really want to keep up on the training stress and you have a power meter and everything else, you can just put it on a free ride and put it in your pocket and record it and be good there. But yeah, it's not necessarily made for outdoors. So, Kevin, major kudos for continuing to produce a great podcast. The episode with the Cliff Bar team was a real highlight. I hope you'll do more like these. And we do have plans to do more like those. So that'll be good. On some of the Trainer Road workouts like Thimble, the text at the end of the warm-up talks about performing a, and this is in quotes, LSCT. Can you explain what that is, how it's used, and whether it's useful? Keep up the great work. This podcast is now a staple of my lower intensity workouts, and it makes the time go by a little quicker.
Kevin, the LSCT stands for Lambert Submaximal Cycle Test. And basically, it's a protocol that you can follow prior to each workout that serves a dual purpose. So one of those purposes is to warm you up. The second purpose is to give you some indication of whether or not it basically measures recovery, tells you whether or not is a good day to go hard. Am I going to be able to eke the intended benefit out of the workout ahead? And there's actually an entire blog post on it. So if you go to blog.trainerroad.com and you plug in LSCT, he'll come to a article titled Green Light, Red Light, Submaximal Warm-Up. And it'll give you tons of information, and it'll also link you to the formal study on the Lambert & Lambert cycle test, submaximal cycle test. But the gist of it is it's a test you can do that is submaximal, meaning it never even puts you above threshold. And there's three different steps and then actually a small fourth step. And you just watch what your heart rate does on the first, you know, maybe I think it's roughly around 60% of threshold. You know, a couple of minutes into it, does my heart rate stabilize? Is it higher than normal, lower than normal? Then on the next step up, which is 6 minutes long, you give it a minute for it to stabilize. And again, you know, is it higher than normal, lower than normal? How do I feel today? And then you spend a couple minutes just short of threshold, 3 minutes. So the course of the warm-up takes 20 minutes, doesn't wipe you out, gives you some insight into how fresh you're feeling that day. After those three steps, there's additionally 1 minute where you just sit up and see how quickly your heart rate recovers. All this stuff, there are no hard, fast rules to it, but as you use it more frequently, you start to notice trends. I notice that when I hit that second step and my heart rate comes up to 135 BPM, I'm recovered and I'm probably going to have a good workout. I confirm that in that next 3 minutes where I'm riding at threshold and my heart rate reaches or gets pretty close to threshold heart rate. I'm feeling pretty good today. I think this is going to be a good workout. And then over time, you can see, you know, you start to establish personal heart rate trends. And you mix perceived exertion, you know, how you feel into that as well. And we've also incorporated power into it. So at a particular power, do I see the typical heart rate that tells me I'm going to have a good workout? So really, that onus is on you, and that you have to accumulate a fair amount of data so that you can start mapping these trends and seeing, is this a good day? And you may get to a point where you start a workout, you know you're feeling flat, you get into this LSCT warm-up, and you see, indeed, I'm flat, I'm just going to ride endurance today and postpone this workout till tomorrow.
Hopefully it gets you all the information you need on that one. I don't have anything to add there. Chad nailed it. So Sean says, I've been experimenting with doing some endurance rides in a fasted state. Could you explain what is actually occurring physically when doing this type of workout and what adaptations you're trying to achieve? Also, how long do you recommend the fasting if I can't do a morning ride? If I go 6 or 8 hours during the day without eating, then do a training session, is that enough? You've recommended 60 to 90 minutes into a workout before eating or drinking anything. If I can push longer before feeling a bonk, is that creating even more positive adaptation of the body using fat in lieu of glucose? So these are great questions. Let's take them one.
Yeah, they're all good questions. So the adaptations we're looking for, physiologically speaking, are improved aerobic capacity. So we're trying to improve your ability to metabolize fat for fuel and consequently spare sugar. So by coming into these fasted, and there's actually another purpose, and that's weight loss. So by coming into these fasted, you don't have sugar to burn. Your body has to metabolize fat. You burn a little extra butter, hopefully lose a little extra weight. But the physiological adaptation we're after is more mitochondria. We want cells that can use more oxygen, burn more fat. And this has, basically, it just increases your aerobic engine, which is important across the board. It doesn't matter if you're a short power sort of rider, one who's constantly flooding the system with lactate. That lactate has to be dealt with, and it's dealt with aerobically. So the bigger your aerobic engine is, it's going to help you across the board. Regardless of what discipline of cycling you're in, it's still an endurance sport. And that's primarily what we're after. And that happens at a genetic level, a cellular level, a muscular level. It's basically just trying to grow your aerobic capacity.
And then he says, coming off endurance and base training, I'm finding build phase workouts are just not conducive to being able to watch TV shows and movies. Jonathan had mentioned he likes watching mountain bike race videos. Could he recommend where I can find good sources for those type of mountain bike race videos? I love to watch these during these harder training sessions. Yeah. Red.TV. If you go there, they have, and then you search, I believe it's, if you go Red Bull TV, or go to redbull.tv and then you go to the live section and then you search for like mountain biking, you'll find the archives on there. It's kind of a tricky way to find them. But
yeah. Hey, too, to go back, we didn't answer one part of Sean's question. Is Chad?
Yeah, there's a few parts we didn't answer.
Oh, shoot. Yeah, yes, so, we didn't. I apologize.
Chad, you want to go through those? Okay.
Yeah, so next question. How long do you recommend fasting if you can't do a morning ride? If I go 6 to 8 hours during the day without eating, then do a training session, is that enough? So what we're looking for here is glycogen depletion. And it's not just glycogen depletion. We're basically trying to condition our slow twitch fibers. And slow twitch fibers take a long time to fatigue. But if we can kind of set the stage and accelerate that fatigue by denying them the fuel that they prefer, the sugar, then you go into it and it's almost like they're pre-exhausted. So you're almost getting that training stimulus much earlier than you'd have to if you went out with a full belly and had to ride for 3 or 4 or 5 hours to achieve the same effect.
So question there, Chad. If I'm doing a endurance ride in a fasted state, should it feel harder than if I'm all sugared up?
Yeah, so you're going to be limited. I mean, if you're really don't have any sugar to contribute, there's going to be a cap on your power. So you're going to have to kind of keep the intensity fairly light such that the fat metabolism can support the workload. And you'll know when you go above it, you'll have very little time there. And, you know, it's to dispel a misunderstanding, you're never glycogen depleted. I mean, you can't get 100% glycogen depleted. Yeah. I think you can,
you've shown that over.
you can run your stores. Yeah. You can run your stores down to about 30% of baseline. But you can't deplete them fully. If you depleted them, it would amount to rigor, you know, muscular rigor. Your muscles would seize up, no fuel to do anything. So it's always there. So even when you're doing these fasted rides and you think you're completely out of sugar, but you can work for a couple seconds, well, you're using some sugar that your body probably doesn't really want to let you use, but will. But you're not going to be able to do it for very long. So just don't work that hard. Tone it down a bit and recognize that the goal today is to fatigue your slow twitch muscles, your more aerobic muscles. And that takes time or it takes glycogen depletion or a combination of the two.
Chad, I've heard the 12-hour deal being thrown out there before, that 12 hours is kind of the ideal thing for fasted training. You want to go 12 hours since your last meal. Is that... How does that relate here to the 6 to 8 hours that he said?
Honestly, I don't know. I know that, you know, after an overnight fast, your liver doesn't hold a lot of glycogen. So pretty safe to say that's gonna be gone. And then what's stored in your muscles is, you know, another 60 to 90 minutes, which is why I think he's mentioning the 60 to 90 minutes before eating or drinking or anything. It's actually just the opposite. I'm not sure if that got misinterpreted or if we misstated that, but we want you to recognize that it's going to take 60 or 90 minutes to deplete anything that's in your muscles before you actually start achieving the adaptations or the stimulus that we're trying to create.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wait, so if I were to, let's say I didn't eat a lot of carbs the night before and I went to bed mm-hmm. and I woke up in the morning and I did a 60-minute workout, would that help me burn fat or not?
Yeah, especially if you went, so you depleted your glycogen the night before, which means that sets the stage
because I'm in a fast state
for the next day. Exactly. So all you're trying to do is run down your glycogen stores. Just see to it that they're gone so that when you start your low intensity workout, you don't have anything to metabolize but fat or primarily fat.
So what you're saying then is if I wasn't in a fasted state, it's going to be 90 minutes before I even get there. But if I am in a fasted state, I can get those benefits a lot earlier. So when he says he goes 60, go ahead, Chad.
No, that's fine. Go on.
So when he says, if I can go 6 to 8 hours during the day without eating and then doing a training session, is that enough?
Yeah, that's another way to go about it. You're coming into it depleted. So then you do your endurance ride and achieve the effects that we would get after an overnight fast. So if you've actually run down your glycogen stores to a point where you're operating in a pretty much fasted state, then the effect will be the same.
It's probably easier to achieve that effect with overnight fasting.
And that's why that's the recommended method. You don't want to spend 8 hours, you know, go into a workout knowing it's 8 hours away and you're not going to eat anything between now and then. It's a lot more difficult than simply going to bed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. He says, if I can push longer before feeling a bonk, is that creating even more positive adaptation of my body using fat in lieu of glucose? So I think he's talking about feeling something coming on and pushing all the way into the edge of it.
Yeah. So I don't know if you're saying you want to push past the point of discomfort to where you're really miserable. I'm not sure if the benefit outweighs the cost in that case. Or I also am not sure if you're talking about that you're becoming more fat adapted and you're finding that you can last longer, or that your aerobic efficiency is on the rise and you can ride longer. Should you ride longer? In that case, you know, you can just basically further the stimulus, and rather than doing an hour and a half fasted, now you're doing two and a half hours fasted. That's just a measure or an indication that you've improved your aerobic efficiency.
Yeah, I actually have noticed this as a sugar athlete. My longer endurance rides, but doing water, and then I'll get to a point where maybe this is what people, I had a little rant a couple podcasts ago about bonking. I think that what I feel is like a low blood sugar, and I start mm-hmm. to feel bad, just like I would be hungry if I wasn't working out. Not necessarily what I term bonking, where you run out of glycogen and you fall over and you can't walk. Mm-hmm. But should I be pushing through this stage, or should I try to eat something when I do feel that kind of like, you know, that shaky, weak feeling that you get mm-hmm. when you haven't had anything?
Yeah. In fact, just Saturday, I rode through about an hour of that. And honestly, it's spurred me to want to read up on that, because I honestly don't know what effect, if there's a further effect by working through that misery, or if you just kind of reach a point where the message is sent, the genetic signaling that needs to take place is happening, the slow twitch fibers have received the stimulus. Now they're going to work on adaptation, given proper recovery, et cetera. I don't know if there's any benefit to pushing past that. I honestly don't.
Well, I hope there's not.
yeah, so do I.
Don't we all?
I should probably mention this because we talked about it before. Chad and I both bought blood sugar monitors. I'm still figuring mine out. I have this little Contour one, and I used it, and I took 4 readings in a row. My blood sugar was 118, 110, 90 something, and 78 within like 3 minutes. So if you guys know, that goes between you're diabetic and you really need something. I mean, that's a huge range from the very low end to the high end. I read a little bit about this blood sugar monitor, and it said that they're 20% accurate. So plus or minus, I'm not sure if it was plus or minus 20% actually, or if it was plus or minus 10% and 20% window. But either way, I need to read more about that and see if there's a more accurate one that we can buy, because I'd really like to, in this case, Chad, that's the plan was, is to do these long workouts. And then when I feel that kind of, you know, you get a little shaky and it gets harder, like your legs are fine. It's just like I get it too when I'm hungry. I like get a little bit shaky and you feel like you want to eat some nuts mm-hmm. or something. I want to see if that's my blood sugar crashing, and then what kind of food can I eat that it doesn't spike a whole bunch that I can kind of
We've got a lot of fun experimentation ahead of us, and that's a super good use case right there, is for us to see when we actually feel that come on, what where's our blood sugar. That'll be interesting, and probably pretty interesting for the listeners.
If anyone knows too, send it in. If you know of like a really good blood sugar monitor that will give us accurate results, we'll go ahead and pay for it. Or consistent. Like, I don't even care if they're absolutely accurate, but as long as it's the scale is the same magnitude, and it's, you know, if I'm going to do it four times in a row and I get 118, 119, 118, 117, then I'm happy. When I get 118, 110, 90, 78, whatever, that's it's useless.
You were crashing, Nate. All in the space of 3 minutes. cool. Let's go on to John's question. He says, I'm in week 7 of the new full distance triathlon low volume build plan, and I love it. When I'm doing over-unders or FTP interval work, the instructions on the screen often talk about how my legs are supposed to be burning and just hang in there. I'm concerned because I just don't feel the burn, and I feel the intervals may be too easy. I did my last two FTP tests in November and January on a Wahoo Kicker, and both gave me an embarrassingly low FTP of 156. My words, not mine, forgive me. But I thought, hey, just trust the process, stick with it. So I stuck with that low FTP in my training. Now I'm concerned that I may have been training at too low of an FTP to see the benefits because I'm not feeling that burn. Which, by the way, we actually just put up a podcast today or a blog post today, John, that covers or addresses this exact thing. His question is, should I just bump it up until the over-unders are difficult? Or should I not be concerned because the full distance plan is prepping me for long, low FTP aerobic efforts, and they are supposed to be somewhat, in quotes, easy. I'm a fairly middle-of-the-road age grouper in his early 40s who does a handful of tries, marathons, and halves throughout the year.
So, John, yeah, the eventuality is that you're going to do a full distance race and the intensity is going to be low, but the conditioning in the interim is not going to be easy. And it's not supposed to be easy. We're looking for, you know, big changes in your physical capabilities in minimal time. And we want steady ones that take place over the course of your entire training trajectory. So right now it looks like your FTP is underassessed, and the post that we just put out will definitely steer you in the right direction. Our common recommendation, or our typical recommendation, is to, when the workouts feel too easy, maybe within the, you know, from interval to interval, just nudge it up 2 or 3% and see how it goes from there. But those little on-screen texts that pop up and tell you, you know, this hurts right now, this is hard. Well, if it's not, something's definitely up. And in the case of over-unders, those are miserable. They're literally my least favorite form of workout because they keep you on this narrow, painful edge the entire time. You're either a little above it where you're flooded, and then you're a little below it where you're not comfortably recovering. You're just hanging in there knowing that you're going to have to go above it again. And it's torturous, but it's super effective too if you do it right. And you're not quite there. So Your FTP needs some revisiting.
Yeah, we actually said in that blog post today, we said that one of the litmus tests for you, or one of the key indicators, if you do have a low FTP, it over-unders are a great way to figure that out, because you should be flirting right there and crossing that limit, and you'll feel it, you know.
So should he asked, should I just bump up my FTP until the over-unders are difficult?
I think you're safe to start with as much as a 3, 4, even 5% bump in FTP, and then just see how things go from there over the course of the workout. If that 5% still didn't put you in the realm of discomfort, then you can kind of micro adjust it in there. You know, maybe from interval to interval, or even within the intervals. If it's still just not happening, you're still not getting that burn, maybe nudge it up another couple percent. See how that next over segment goes.
I find that I know that it's right. If I have, let's say you're doing 4 over-unders of 8 minutes long or something, I do the first one and I think, my God, there's no way I can do the last 3.
Yeah.
And then I do the second one and I go, my God, there's no way. Like, as soon as you end the interval, you go, damn you, Chad, there's no way I can do these last 2. And then you get the third one done, and then you go, well, I can do this last one. And then you get the last one done, and then you get off the bike and you're like, wow, that was really hard, but I pushed through it and I made it. And then I know that's right, about right. If I do the first one, I'm like, that was easy. Second one, that was easy. Or if I do the first one, can't make it. Second one, I'm like turning it down. Then maybe I'm having an off day, or you know, I might have need some recovery or turn it down a little
bit. So in your case too, John, you say that you took your, it seems like, and I'm assuming here, but it seems like you're somewhat new to FTP testing because you mentioned a test in November and January. It takes time to get to the point where you can assess, I guess, accurately or assess your FTP accurately. That's pretty tough to do, to be able to extract all of that out of your body when you're on the trainer to get a full assessment. So the more you test, the better you'll do. However, we're not saying that you should test every workout. But as time goes on and you do more FTP tests, you should be able to get a more accurate indication of your FTP from those FTP tests. So Chad, one question that I have is, when should he stop just turning the intensity up and when should he just take a test instead? Or is that advisable?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. I don't have a solid answer for it, save for the fact that if you're within a workout and you're just adjusting, it's probably going to be easier to just bag the workout for the day or schedule an FTP test very soon. And in your case, John, in a lot of people's cases, probably it's hard to do an FTP test. And we've talked about it before. It's just a difficult process. But if you don't, same thing with the over-under workout. If you don't finish that workout feeling like, oh man, that just took everything out of me, that was brutal, probably didn't get a solid representation of your FTP. So if that FTP test isn't at least a little bit dreaded and you're not just completely spent afterwards, you probably have more to give.
Yeah, he's established that at least right now, he could be a newer rider, that he's bad at FTP tests. And mm-hmm. I think FTP tests are probably 10% skill, 90% mental. Bumping up his FTP. So like changing his percentage, and let's say he goes up 5%, that feels good for him. I would then go back and after that workout, see what 5% more of your FTP is and update your FTP and then go through some more workouts. And then if they're still easy for the threshold and over-unders, that kind of thing, bump it up again. And
sure, that sounds like a great recommendation.
Until he kind of like, you'll know, like when it gets too hard. I mean, everyone who's listening who know, mm-hmm. you know when it's too hard, right? It's not like you're going to screw yourself and have your, I mean, if you're all doing endurance work, that's one thing, but you'll feel when you hit the limit for your threshold and over-unders, like you'll definitely
and John,
know.
John, you're not alone in this, by the way. Like, I don't want you to think that you're a unique case. Like, we see this so much, right, guys? Like so many questions where people
we've
are
been there. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So. It's just hard to go all out. Like that's why we you know, in the last a couple podcasts ago too, we talk about kind of manually tweaking your FTP as you go. Like there, mm-hmm. you don't have to just do whatever the FTP test told you and just stick with that for 6 weeks and never ever raise it.
Yeah. You can retest, you can bump it up, you can play with it. Ideally, you'll get to, and you will, if you keep testing, you'll get to the point where you will test to your capacity and the workouts will be just fine. And then when you retest every 4 to 6 weeks, it'll work itself out. But in the interim,
it comes with experience.
If it's not working out well, these are good tips that you can use to kind of fine tune things in between. So, Pablo has a question, and this is fasted training again. That's like the new base training, I think, after that article. So hopefully no one's, but this I think is a really good question. I actually have the same question myself. So Pablo asks, if you want to do a fasted training workout and say you ride for 45 minutes fasted first thing in the morning, and I think he's talking about commuting, essentially commuting to a meeting point with your team for a high intensity workout. And then after that 45 minutes of commuting, you eat something like a piece of bread, a banana, or a date, or just before your high intensity training. Would this be a good way of getting in your fasted training, but still fueling your high intensity training later on? He's asking this because many times after our workout, I do a few extra hours at medium intensity, but the team training is a very high intensity. So. Yeah, that's a good question.
So, Pablo, I wouldn't recommend this approach. I think it's backwards, actually. So you're going to do a 45-minute fasted ride, burn off any extra glycogen you might have had, and show up for a high-intensity workout. So right there, you're kind of stacking the deck against yourself. You're not loaded up. You're not ready to make the most of what promises to be difficult. and you're eating right before it. But I fear that if that thing's goes from the gun, then you're not gonna have the glucose in your system at that point. You're eating just prior to the actual workout. So my recommendation would be to eat whatever it is you're going to eat prior to that 45 minute commute. Show up topped off. Give it everything you have for the team portion of it, the high intensity portion. And then those extra few hours afterwards is when you start restricting your carbohydrate intake. So if you're looking for the fasted response and you're looking to do it on, in this case, in just a few hours afterwards, you may not need any food or very little food afterwards. That's when you're basically starving the muscles of sugar and targeting those sought after adaptations that fasted training is all about.
This comes with a huge grain of salt, okay? This is more just anecdotal and fun to listen to hear. But I remember reading about Lance, and he used to do his races, and then his coach would have him do like 3 hours of training of moderate afterwards. We all know about Lance. We need to talk about him. But that's just interesting. Yeah,
I actually employed this very tactic on Saturday. I only had a couple hours, but I wanted to effectively get what the benefit that I would get over a 4 or 5 hour endurance ride. So I went out, and for the first hour, I played around. I went fasted, by the way. So all I had was coffee out of bed, got on the bike, rode for the first hour, incorporated some efforts, pushed myself to a point where I was starting to feel flat, and I knew I was running low. And then I just basically shifted down, put it in the small ring, rode for another 2 hours on nothing but water. And it, same idea. I depleted the glycogen stores. So I depleted my blood glucose. I've got nothing left to burn but butter, basically fat. So I had to ride at a low intensity level. And, ideally now I'm targeting my slow twitch fiber fatigue, which is what we're after. And I did it in this reverse order.
So change the order of things, Pablo, and you could be onto something there. So Creso has a question, and he's from Croatia. That's cool, man. We get questions from people all over the world, I assume, because I can't pronounce some of your names very well. But if you guys put in where you're from, that's cool. That's that always lets us know how far away our voices are reaching here. It's cool stuff. So he says, first of all, I could not praise your podcast enough. Great job, guys. This is something special. You're providing so many valuable pieces of information to us. It's amazing. That's cool. That's exactly what we're about. I don't know if you've already spoke about oval chain rings, but I'm interested in this topic. I've read quite a few articles and reviews, but they're mainly inconsistent, and it's not clear if they really help or not. I always read that they are better suited for the slow grind type of rider than the high cadence spinners. I fall somewhere in between. I'm not just interested in them in terms of road cycling, but also mountain biking. Seems they could help in better traction on climbs and to save the knees a little. Thanks in advance. Best regards from Croatia.
Just so before you guys Creso answer, before. Go ahead. I feel the same way, is that I've read so much stuff on it, and there are people
that's
like,
basically,
oh,
what
this
I'm gonna
is
say.
Awesome, and then other ones say it's not, and I don't know.
Yeah, there's nothing definitive, and anecdotally, or N equals one, just me, I use them, and what I've noticed is I have less knee pain. So when I go back to round rings and I start doing high intensity, 2 minute, 3 minute sort of repeats on the trainer, my knees, I'm getting old. My knees get sore from time to time. They seem to get more sore when I use round rings. I go back to the asymmetric ring or asymmetric rings, the ovals, and that knee pain distinctly lessens.
Mm. So I'm running them, Creso, on my mountain bike, and I'm on board with you guys in saying that I don't know if really the whole concept is that it leverages the asymmetrical nature of the pedal stroke, and that it somehow makes you more efficient. And I'm not really sure if that's the case, but for mountain biking, there are two perks that I can actually say do work. And really these are specific to mountain biking. They are not, they don't translate over to road. Number one is traction. Theoretically, it should smooth out the traction or smooth out the power delivery to the rear wheel. Because of the shape of the chain rings, therefore giving you better traction, less surging. It should. Then I honestly feel like my bike has fantastic. My new bike, I have them on there, and it's incredible the stuff that I can stick on. However, I don't know if that's just the bike because I didn't ride it with round rings.
Yeah. You love that bike. So I think we put anything on that and you'd be like, oh, this is the best thing ever.
This is a true story. I love it. It's a Yeti ASRC. It's incredible. It's so good. But then here's the thing that it does help with, pedal bob. And it's kind of, it's the same theory. However, I've noticed that it doesn't help across all cadences. So if I'm pedaling at a quick cadence, it seems to stabilize any type of pedal bob you have. And for those that don't know, pedal bob is when your bike, a full suspension bike, there are a lot of different rear suspension designs, and some of them are designed to keep you riding very high in the stroke, while some of them, when you sit on the bike, it settles in further than others. And as a result, you get either a very firm feeling pedaling platform or a very soft, spongy feeling pedaling platform. And everybody wants to pedal on a firm platform, but when they descend, they want it to be a very soft feeling shock, right? So you want the best of both worlds. But this does do, I have noticed, if I'm riding at a higher cadence, the bike smooths out substantially. If I am not riding, which usually with a bike that is prone to pedal bob, riding at a higher cadence actually makes it worse. But in this case, it actually does the opposite. But if I'm riding at a slower cadence, I almost feel like it might make it worse. So you mentioned that it's better for slow grind riders. I don't know about that, but traction and pedal bob, those two things, theoretically, it should address the traction issue in a pretty measurable way. But and then with the pedal bob stuff, I can attest to that. At a higher cadence for me, it does help. And I'm using the Absolute Black rings. So they're not like really exaggerated like those, what are they, Osymmetrics, Chad, the ones that you can get that are like practically square.
Yeah, I think that's what Dave rides, the Osymmetric. Mm-hmm. And then rotors are subtly ovalized. Yeah. More subtly.
I think Dave, too. Dave is our videographer, high level races internationally. He was on the podcast a while ago. He's the same way, right? He's like, I don't know. I think they do something, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it's really tough to tell. I guess traction should be easier to measure than others, than just perception. But, you know, it all depends. Hope that gives you some insight there. Pierre. Hi, all. As a long user of Trainer Road, should be over 3 years. I've seen the most of the application. Even though I hadn't started using the structured training plans until this winter, I've been very fond of it so far. So keep up the good work. I'm looking forward to your Android release and the new desktop app. So I assume he's talking about the PC app. If so, Pierre, it's already there. Grab it. It's good.
PC app's there, working on the Mac and Android. Sorry, Android users. I know there's a reason why there's in this order, and I can't always be public about it all, but Android, it's coming.
It's on its way. It's on its way.
I feel so bad because they are so passionate Android users, and I so want to out. I mean, I wanted it out 2 years ago. We only have so many engineers, and
we don't have anything personal against it. Like, I know the Android Apple thing is super personal for a lot of people, and we don't have that. It's just, this is the path we've had to take. And like Nate said, we wish that we could build for every platform all at once. It'd be awesome. But
if I had a whole bunch more, if you're Android, tell your friends about Trainer Road. Because if I had a whole bunch of more users, I could hire more engineers and I could have a dedicated Android team rather than have engineers switch from platform to platform.
That'd be awesome.
The woes of a startup.
Yeah, that's how it goes. Now to my question. I train in my storehouse and I used to warm it up a couple of hours before I started my sessions. Because I'm often very cold, I usually warm the room to 24 to 25 degrees Celsius. That's about 75 to 77 degrees Fahrenheit. What I have seen is that I get fatigue and quite wet, and he's talking about sweating there, when I perform sessions over 60 minutes. I drink a lot of both water or sports drinks depending on the length of the session. I have a fan, but I don't like to get all the wind on me. Therefore, I don't use it. So that's an interesting point that he says there. So he says, what degrees Celsius do you recommend to have when you do the different, do your different indoor training sessions? Thanks, Pierre.
So Pierre, you're drawing a line or making the distinction between ambient temperature and I guess it'd be evaporative cooling temp. I don't even know what you call that. But anyway, you can only cool a room so much before your body heat kind of negates that effect. So you can go into a quite a chilly room, but you start doing VO2 max repeats, and at some point your body temperature is going to have an influence or an effect on just how much work you can do. So I have always advocated, and I'm pretty sure we're all on the same page here, using a big fan. And you don't like it, but frankly, it's limiting the quality of your workouts.
Yeah, so it's So the majority of your cooling is going to be evaporative cooling. So the temperature of the room, if you're in anything like normal, what a house would be from 68 to 77 or what you're talking about, anywhere in there, it's even down to 60. It's going to be the majority, the fan, the evaporative cooling. One thing we've talked about before too is, so on your interval workouts, you don't want to be limited by heat. You don't want that to like stop you. So on those workouts, you know, a cooler room or just whatever's comfortable for you. And then a big fan, not just like a little fan you get at Walmart, a box fan, but a real powerful fan that will encourage evaporative cooling. That's the thing that's going to cool you down. And then if you want to do, there's been studies showing that if you do slower endurance rides in a really hot room, like 100 degrees Fahrenheit, that can then improve your fitness, your performance in warm stuff and also in cold also. Mm-hmm. So if you really wanted to heat the room up for, personally, I don't do it because it's a pain in the butt. I just do them all cooled kind of regularly. And then in the summer, I'll do some. If I'm going to race in hot, I'm all training hot too.
Yeah. So I was just going to say to your final question of what degrees Celsius you'd recommend to have when you do different sessions, whatever you're going to be racing in, I think is a good, prepping for race day is a good type of thing. Certainly that's going to help. You know, the fans, I think a lot of people misunderstand. It's a lot like elevation training. A lot of people, like Team Sky, for example, they train low. They want to train low at sea level because they have more oxygen or more readily available oxygen to utilize. Then that means that they can train at a higher level during that day when they're down low. Then they recover up high. So that's their goal there. So the whole point behind that is they don't want to put themselves at a disadvantage regarding their ability to reach their potential during their workouts. And the same thing you want to do when you're working out inside, even though the fan may be bringing about an adaptation for a hot day, or the lack of a fan may be bringing about an adaptation for a hot day, you're limiting your ability to output high amounts of power for extended periods of time. And that's just,
so if you want to do, if you want to do some heat training, just do it with during the lower intensity rides, like Nate was saying. So if you're prepping for something like Kona, you know, you want to create an environment that's as similar to that as possible so that it's not a serious shock to your system when you face it. And those rides have their place. If heat acclimatization is something you're after, they absolutely have their place. But when it comes to eking the most quality out of a workout as possible, you want everything in your favor. You don't want to create different obstacles, unnecessary ones.
Along this lines, a tangent of this, Chad, you talked about getting in a sauna after some of your workouts to do heat acclimation. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
And I've used it in a limited capacity just going into a team camp, and I definitely plan to use it going into the hotter months here. So that's when I'm going to have plenty to share on that topic. But in the meantime, I did use it. So we found an article. It spurred some action, bought a sauna, put it in my basement. And the idea is that you follow high intensity workouts when you're all revved up, your body temperature's high, and you go sit in a sauna for, they recommend 30 minutes. And that's what I've been doing, jacked all the way up to 130 degrees. It's pretty uncomfortable, but it's supposed to bring about the same sort of adaptations, the same sort of acclimatization that those heated rides bring about. But all you have to do is sit through. You don't have to work through it, which I find far more tolerable than trying to do even low intensity rides in a hot basement where I'm just dripping sweat the whole time.
We're actually looking to get a new building here in about 10 months when our lease runs out here. And one thing we're talked about is getting a sauna big enough there that we can put our trainers in them and do that. That would be very interesting. So
yeah,
we could set 100 and right in there.
That
Come
sounds
on,
miserable.
Chad, for science.
I'd rather do the training in a cool environment and then sit in the hot sauna and watch some Netflix afterwards.
So you're going to you'll have to put your phone if you're doing it with phone outside of a window because I brought my phone into saunas before and it shuts down because it says too hot. But can you imagine fasted workout in the morning in endurance at 100 degree,
just
talk
mash
about
it
mental
all together.
Training. Yeah, I'm going to do everything.
You'll be a lab rat, Nate, a poorly treated lab rat by your own method.
It sounds interesting right? I don't even know. Your power meter might go crazy though too because
I just don't know if there's an advantage.
Consistent.
I just don't know why you would train at such a high temperature. I mean, I could see you doing like 90 degrees, 95 degrees, but sauna temperatures seem a bit...
Well, 100. I think the study that I'm looking at, I think they did it at like 100 or 101. And they had people do 45 minutes of, it was like 60% of threshold. Yeah.
How big is your sauna, Chad? Out of curiosity.
It's a two-person. So it fits in my basement. My basement has 6-foot ceilings. So it just squeezes under the rafters. And then it's, I think the footprint is about 3x4.
Okay.
Maybe. No, probably more like 3x3. It's not large at all, but it does the job quite well.
Do you have to hook up water to it, or do you just have a bucket?
No, it's a dry sauna. So it has these little carbon heating elements that draws very little electricity and heats up to 130 degrees. And it was actually pretty affordable, I got to say.
Is there an appeal other than acclimatization to being in a humid environment on race day to having a dry versus a humid sauna?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
Huh. I wonder.
I don't know either. I know in a drier environment, evaporative cooling is easier.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I would assume that. I was just going to say that your evaporative cooling would be limited. So cool stuff.
Yeah, but the benefit with this, the training benefit is aerobic adaptation. So just like with the fasted rides, it's another way to achieve the gains that would otherwise require much harder work or much more work, much more mileage.
One more thing too, to jump back what Jonathan said a little while ago, is that when Team Sky then sleeps high, so they sleep at a high elevation, that is to increase the hematocrit in their blood. So having less oxygen, you do that for a lot. And some people will have like oxygen tents over their bed so they can simulate a high elevation. And then, like you said, again, train low, you have no limiters with a whole bunch of oxygen. And I actually was part of a study I think I mentioned this before, but I trained in a, hypoxic? Yeah, extra oxygen. So more oxygen than sea level.
Hyperoxic. And
hyperoxic, yeah. Yeah, hyperoxic, not hypo. And that actually made my running test, my RPE was less. I don't think that product ever got out there, but it's pretty interesting.
Interesting stuff. Cool. Sam, he says, hi, I'm a junior cyclist and I'm currently right under 5 watts per kilogram. Good job, Sam. That's strong. I didn't do too much interval training last year, but I've definitely stepped it up this year. I was able to accomplish my best power test yet after the off season, I believe, from just doing weightlifting alone. So, and Sam, you mentioned you're a junior cyclist. You're also probably, you're just growing too and getting more stronger, or getting stronger. So he says, so my question is, how much improvement can I expect to get within a year of training, considering that I do interval work on a regular basis? I know it's a hard question to answer, but a ballpark estimate from experience would be great. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, we can all sit and guess, Sam, and base it on experience such that we can get you in that ballpark. You're already at 5 watts a kilo, though. So we've talked about in the past how it gets exponentially harder to achieve gains as you get exceptionally fit, and you're already exceptionally fit. So what you're going to, we don't know what your capacity is. Obviously, you've got some genetic inclination, good work ethic. You probably train pretty consistently if you're already this fit. So I could see you pushing up to 5.5 watts a kilogram if I had to guess over the course of a year. That's a big jump for someone, but you sound young, you sound driven, and the fact that you haven't really trained with much structure up till this point says you still have some room to grow.
I was just going to say too that your power to weight ratio may not be the best thing, or may not tell the whole story, in this case especially. So I work with junior racers with a junior team here in Reno, and I see a lot of kids that have great, really high power to weight ratios, but their ability to put out that power dynamically, in other words, if it's repeated efforts or if it's sustained efforts or anything else like that, if it's not in a specific scenario, it can get tough. I would say that as a junior cyclist, where you can really gain a lot of ground is, having that high power to weight ratio is kind of like your ticket to get into the show. But then once you get there, what you actually do with that power, that's what really matters. And strategy and tactics, because of the fact that junior races tend to be much more emotional, less thought out, less tactical. They tend to be more irrational. So if you can be the type of person that comes into this knows that you can, whether it's just sustain a long breakaway or knows that you can match attacks until you need to launch your own, and then you can really make that one stick. Whatever it may be, being able to put out that power in the way that will win a race rather than just have you right up there with the top guys and contending for it, I'd say that's worth focus.
Jonathan, with your work with juniors too, how much do you see, like, for watts per kilo if someone's like 13, 14, 15, you know, then 17 and 18? Because there's a lot of growth that could happen and you could gain a lot of weight. And how does, like, huge. Do you see a lot of young kids at that high watts per kilo and then it might go down as they get bigger? Or?
Yeah. So we've seen one kid, I think, is probably up above right now. He's up above 5.5, I would say. He's just incredibly, incredibly fit. But last year, he was testing at just, you know, high fours, so right where you are, Sam. The change that happened with him was he's gotten to the point now where he was already lean, but he's extremely lean now. His body is leaning out, and a lot of that is from the training, but a lot of it is just from natural process that he's going through. He's leaning out, that's helping, but he's also just his muscles are growing, that's helping out. He can change a lot more of how his body's working, but it's really strange. You tend to see, like, where kids actually start out with a pretty high power to weight ratio, and then puberty tends to screw everything up. in that respect, they go through a point where they start to get fat, and then that makes them slower. And then they go to this point where it totally switches again if they continue training for most, and it seems like they really start to lean out. So it's kind of a roller coaster thing, and adding more credence to my previous advice that your power to weight ratio may not tell the whole story. Your ability to put out that power in different environments really does help. So, but we've seen kids that are 13 years old with thresholds above 4.5. It's crazy.
I just remember in eighth grade, I grew a foot, and I just, like, oh man, I was so tired all the time. And if I tried to, like, train on top of that. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I could just, it just throws another, like, wrench in the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It can get complicated. Well, that'll do it for this week's questions. Thanks for submitting them, guys. And you can submit them to us at support@trainerroad.com on our new podcast landing page, which you should be able to find. Oh, we'll see if it gets
Jonathan,
out.
Then it might not be out.
It's coming soon if it's not out. But just the same, it'll be a much easier way for you guys to submit questions, so you can look forward to that. And we'll give you more information on that when it is actually out. So, but it's just something to look forward to. Leave us a review on iTunes, on SoundCloud, on Stitcher, anywhere else. Leave comments on SoundCloud and share the podcast with your friends. I'm sure other people have questions too that they need answering. So thanks for joining us, guys, and thanks for the questions. Happy training.
Thanks again, everyone.
Bye-bye.